From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurraham Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. President Obama visited Hiroshima, Japan, and called for nations to reconsider the development of nuclear weapons and ultimately eliminate them. It was the first time an American president had visited the city where a United States warplane dropped an atomic bomb in 1945, killing an estimated 140,000 people and leading quickly to the end of the war between the United States and Japan. In Washington, an investigation by a State Department inspector found that Hillary Clinton had violated rules and ignored warnings of national security breaches with the private email system she used as Secretary of State. In an odd twist, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders challenged Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential candidate, to a debate. And across the United States, an Obama administration directive on the use of bathrooms by transgender people created a noisy controversy. Well, the president, I'll start with you, David, went to Hiroshima. Many Americans have been there before, but not a president. I'm a little surprised that a president had never been there. But if the first one was going to be now, I'm not surprised it's Obama. Now, what did you make of his visit? You know, they had said beforehand, well, he's not going to apologize. And of course, he didn't.
I think what's fascinating is looking back at the context, and some people were digging out some really interesting historical press cuttings. So if you go back to the 50th anniversary of this in 1995, and Fred, I'm sure you covered this at the time, there was a gigantic row because the Smithsonian Institution, very close to where we're sitting in this studio, was going to put on a commemorative half-century exhibition. They were going to have parts of the Enola Gay, the bomber that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and they had a display explaining the kind of the history. And you had such pushback from veterans of World War II and from members of Congress that the New York Times of the day, if you look at the cuttings, they had to rewrite the text five times. Then eventually they had to pull the text completely. And all they managed was a tiny piece of the fuselage and a sort of a simple kind of terse plaque. And this was because at the time, obviously, you had a lot of World War II veterans alive. And it was incredibly sensitive to suggest that America had done anything other than kind of humanely ended the war quickly. And that was a very live issue. I think what's fascinating now is that the political row, such as there has been, and it really hasn't been a gigantic row on this side, is mostly about American domestic politics. So those Republicans who are foreign policy hawks, who accuse President Obama of apologizing for everything America has ever done, kind of half-heartedly weighed in and said that this was more of the same. But the whole sort of neuralgia around the war and Japan and that bombing, it's amazingly just sort of absent, I think, from debate here.
You know, about the strongest argument against the president on this visit, I think, David, is that, well, why hasn't he been to Pearl Harbor? Why isn't he going there? Well, what would be the anniversary for Pearl Harbor in December? And maybe he'll go there. Abdi?
Well, if I may build on what David has just said, I mean, the extraordinary nature of the visit to me centers around that particular moment when he hugged the Hiroshima survivor. And that particular moment to me has two components. One is the serene and seemingly heartfelt attitude that Obama himself took when he hugged the survivor, knowing that the Japanese were not really particularly nice to some of their neighbors in the region during World War II. And I'm sure if I was sitting in China, for example, looking at Obama hugging, even without apologizing, hugging a survivor, I'm not sure to what extent I would be pleased with that. And then there's the second opponent, which is the heartfelt embrace reciprocated by the Hiroshima survivor, the Japanese Hiroshima survivor. For somebody like that who witnessed that kind of destruction unleashed during World War II by the Americans, regardless of how the Americans saw it, whether they saw it as an act of greater mercy or not, but the heartfelt nature reciprocated by that survivor, it summed up everything that you could say about how two nations once at war have now the possibility to reconcile.
Well, I think they have reconciled. Going back to 1995, David, you mentioned that. Then there was still a strong feeling. There were a lot of World War II survivors. I knew some and have talked to some who were actually in Okinawa at the time of the bombing, first in Hiroshima and then in Nagasaki, and have thought that it spared their lives, that if there were going to be a amphibious assault on Japan, thousands of Japanese would be killed, but mainly thousands of Americans would be killed. And I think that was one of the main reasons for it, was to save American lives, maybe, tens of thousands of them.
I think, there clearly is a very strong historical case that the bomb did shorten the war, mm-hmm. and people will always debate that. I think one of the fascinating things, once you get into the question of apologies, and you saw the White House, when they were briefing this visit, getting into this question of, well, what about Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who is, after all, one of the more nationalist, conservative politicians we've seen in recent times running Japan. His own father was a prominent nationalist, so he comes very much from that wing of Japanese politics, which is extremely opposed to the idea of apologizing for World War II. This is one of the explanations for this visit to Hiroshima, I think, this week, is, of course, there's geopolitics at stake. Japan is not only an important commercial ally, it's not only an important East Asian ally, where there's tons and tons of American troops and bases. It's also an ally against China. What else has changed since 1995? Back in 1995, American political debate was about Japanese companies buying up American assets, about Japanese cars, about Japanese tariffs, about Japanese currency manipulation. And China was something of a kind of, you know, it was a rising power. There was discussions about whether it could join the WTO, but it was not this gigantic kind of force in American politics. Now, of course, everything that an American president does in that region with Japan, with South Korea, is seen through the lens of, does this contain, does this hedge, does this offer some kind of partnership around China's rise?
I realize I don't have any polling that can answer this question, Abdi, but what do you think people around the world were expecting? I mean, how do people look at Hiroshima? As something horrible that America did? As something necessary? As something unfortunate? Something that happens in war or what?
I mean, I would imagine that in at least several parts of the world that are removed from, you know, American perception of the war, Hiroshima is something that exists mainly to them in movies. It's almost unreal. To bring back the details of what actually happened at that moment when the bomb was dropped on Japanese, it's not even real for many Americans, so you can imagine how less real it is for other people around the world. But I think given that there are large chunks of the world where conflict continues to rage, not with nuclear weapons, and this is something that Obama touched upon, with more primitive weaponry, as he called it, and the kind of damage that's doing, I'm not sure to what extent people, for example, in the Middle East, are focused on the issue of Hiroshima and what was used in Hiroshima. They're in places like Syria, they're much more focused on what barrel bombs are doing to civilians. And that's the absurd part of this whole Hiroshima issue, what it means for Americans, what it means for the Japanese, what it means for the Chinese, as opposed to what it means to other people in other parts of the world.
I don't mean to belabor this issue, but there was actually another raid, which was a huge deal in the United States, the so-called Doolittle raid, which is a few months into the war in 1942, a raid of bombers that bombed Tokyo and flew and then landed in China because the planes couldn't have enough fuel in those days to bomb there and then fly back to an aircraft carrier. And the books have been written about it. There have been many books. I actually knew a couple of the pilots who obviously died many years ago. But it was a very big deal at the time. And I think even for Americans, the enthusiasm for it was so great because Pearl Harbor had been bombed and the U.S. was not doing well. To have this raid on Tokyo was a great stir in America. And the whole Hiroshima Nagasaki thing is just something completely different.
I think one thing that's striking about this speech in Japan is it's a bookend with the very first time that I saw President Obama give a speech as a journalist. I was based in Europe covering Europe, and I went to Prague to see him give one of the very first speeches on his first foreign trip. And he went to the grounds of Prague Castle and gave this speech to this enormous, incredibly enthusiastic crowd about nuclear disarmament and about how he intended to try and use his political mandate to try and create a world with as few nuclear weapons as possible and to push back against nuclear proliferation. And the very striking thing I've never forgotten is that the crowd in Prague, once he started talking about ridding the world of nuclear weapons, they got bored. It wasn't what they had come to hear.
Hmm.
They wanted to hear. The only time that they went berserk with sort of happiness was when he said, who could have thought that a man like me could get elected president of America? That's what Europeans were kind of excited about.
Really?
A black man had become president of America. But his nuclear weapons, which was for him his big kind of moral cause, fell on completely deaf ears. No one was very excited by this, but it was, he chose that as one of his first big speeches for a reason. It was meant to be his big kind of push for
you know,
his administration.
There was a debate 30, 40 years ago about whether nuclear weapons are actually good to have because they keep the peace. This was Margaret Thatcher, the British Prime Minister's argument with Ronald Reagan. When he advocated in 1986 at Reykjavik, Iceland, getting rid of nuclear weapons completely, I know she was upset and of course told Reagan so later because they are so destructive, which we know from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that nobody would use them. So they had a peacekeeping effect as sort of...
One of many reasons why Ronald Reagan be drummed out of today's Republican Party as a left-wing squish.
Well, maybe that reason. I don't think there is that many reasons, but you don't hear many Republicans advocating that now, the complete elimination of nuclear weapons.
Can I just
add
a quick thought? You know, this visit to Hiroshima, to me, it looks like part of the hat trick that Obama has pulled off at a time in his administration when usually an American president would be seen as a lame duck. The hat trick is the deal with Iran, then the visit to Cuba, and now the visit to Hiroshima, although he didn't go as far as to actually apologize. But the sheer fact that you have a sitting U.S. president visiting Hiroshima for the first time in over 70 years is, for him, whether people get rid of nuclear weapons in his lifetime or not in his lifetime, as he said, it's something that historically will be counted for him.
A hat trick. Yeah, think of that. That's a hockey term, of course. Scoring.
It's also a soccer term.
When you score three goals in a game. Yes, but anyway, okay. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes, of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Abderrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues in the News as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/archive/issues-in-the-news. This show is going to be hard to avoid. It's available in so many places. Well, let's talk about Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, now the Democratic presidential candidate, likely to win the nomination by her party. But she's had this report from the Inspector General at the State Department, David, and I'm sure you've read about it, of course, and this has been an issue with her email system all along. Many of the things she has said before seem to have been repudiated by this report about, well, there have been many, many things, but I'm not going to run down them. But what's your reaction?
Look, I think if Hillary Clinton was a young, not very well-known politician who had no track record of changing her tune and skirting on the edge of the truth, and this was her very first kind of run with trouble, then we'd be looking at this and saying it's not a very serious thing. You know, it was to be mostly a technical problem that she was so concerned about not having her personal emails sort of acquired by journalists with freedom of information requests or whatever, that she skirted the rules and she skirted the regulations. And we wouldn't be that excited about it. The problem is that when you go out on the election trail, as I do all the time at the moment, and you talk to voters and you ask them what they think about Hillary Clinton, whether they are grudgingly thinking of voting for her with their head, though their heart isn't in it, or whether they are Republicans who loathe her with every fiber of their being, the one reason that people offer before any other for not liking her is that they don't trust her and that they think that she's sneaky. And so you've got these two things. This report is relatively technical about a relatively obscure issue. She didn't kill anyone. She didn't steal any money. She didn't take a bribe. You know, it's about email regulations. But it does feed this narrative that the Clintons think that they're above the rules, that they obey the letter, not the spirit of regulations and rules, and that they change their tune and they're willing to lie to get out of trouble when they're caught doing this stuff. And so I don't think it's fatal. I think it's another way in which her kind of, like a Shakespearean kind of villain in the fourth act, you know, she's going to drag herself with a million daggers in her back across the line, basically. It's not a fatal blow, but it's bad.
You know, Abdi, I agree with David on all this. I think it's bad, but I just wonder whether this issue has been around of Hillary Clinton's emails with the Secretary of State and what happened there and the breaches of national security and whether she knew the rules or not. We know the whole thing. But I sort of think that maybe people have already made up their mind on this, that this is really not new information. It just comes from a different source, the Inspector General at the State Department.
I find it interesting that the New York Times has described this as a distraction for her. I think that in normal situations where you're having conversations between or among normal human beings, yes, you could describe it as a distraction. There's nothing normal about the present atmosphere in this election. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders on one side, Donald Trump on the other side. I think Donald Trump will certainly have, when the chips are down, so much material to work with to attack Hillary Clinton with. One of them is this distraction, which I guess at some point it will become more than just a distraction for her. It will become an issue, that's my prediction, an issue of substance. And Donald Trump has given us plenty of examples of how he can turn an issue that he wants to turn into a real issue, how he can successfully do it. Remember that it's not just the emails that he has to work with. There's something else which is connected to the emails, and that is the name of Huma Abedin, the aide to Hillary Clinton. Huma Abedin is of Pakistani origin, of Muslim background, thoroughly loyal to Hillary Clinton. But we know that Hillary Clinton had been attacked, the Obama administration had been attacked because of Abedin, Abedin being accused of being a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. These are accusations coming from the right. And although you had John McCain defending her, now that her name keeps cropping up in this investigation about the emails, I think may ultimately give even greater force to the attacks that the Trump camp may launch against Hillary Clinton. Having said that, we know that the Clintons are a very powerful machine, and I'm sure that they also will dig up enough material to work with against Donald Trump, especially if he becomes the official nominee of the Republicans.
But it looks like he does. I mean, you've broached the name Donald Trump. My theory in Washington is that every conversation in Washington now on any subject leads to discussing Donald Trump, no matter what, any political subject. Trump has so dominated not just the media, but everybody's thinking about the campaign.
As it should. We have not had someone of his sort as the major party nominee ever. He is manifestly, morally, and in terms of his experience and his competence and his honesty and his approach to the truth, he is manifestly unfit for public office, and he is running for the highest public office in the world.
And basically tied with Hillary Clinton in polls, match-up polls.
Yeah, now, and so your
this
point
is very early.
Your point about the email details being just adding to what we know, I think is very well taken. So you basically have a chunk of people on both sides, maybe it's 40% of the electorate on each side, who have already made up their minds about, I mean, certainly, you know, you go to a Trump rally, which is a very small group of people, but you go to a Trump rally, they think Hillary Clinton should be in prison. And if you ask them why she should be in prison, they say, well, you know, Benghazi and emails. But it doesn't really mean, you know, they have this and this detailed point to make. It's just a kind of gut instinct. And each new piece of information that comes out is just another kind of brick to put onto that kind of wall. Clearly, where this matters to her and what she must now be gaming out, I assume, is that middle chunk of voters. So if you start thinking about very specific groups of people, say, for example, reasonably conservative suburban mothers in the suburbs around places like Denver or Philadelphia, who voted for President Obama in 2008, who may have voted for the Republican Mitt Romney in 2012, who are basically pretty much the only sort of swing voters in swing states that we know of in this very, very divided country. Will they, who are already, they're clearly very upset by Donald Trump, they don't like his misogyny, they don't like his bigotry, they don't like his personality, will this just make it impossible for them to hold their noses and vote for Hillary Clinton? It's on those kind of margins that it probably matters.
I mean, if Hillary Clinton keeps using the term loose cannon to describe Donald Trump, and ironically, it's those descriptions especially with the kind of people that David is talking about, who are staunch supporters of Donald Trump, those add to his strength rather than, you know,
really?
Rather than inflict damage on him. There are people who, because they see him as a loose cannon, they see him as a loose cannon against the establishment, the people who are completely disenchanted with the establishment. They want a loose cannon, and when they listen to him, basically, and they listen to his raves, to them, they're not raves. To them, you know, it's the kind of thing that they want to hear. That's what makes the strength of Donald Trump in their eyes. They want Hillary Clinton to be a loose cannon, but they think she's not the loose cannon they want. She is the establishment, and she is the establishment who's bungled issue after issue to them, including the issue of the emails.
When you think of being a loose cannon, this past week, Donald Trump has, I think, set the tone for what his campaign's going to be like against Hillary Clinton, assuming they're both the nominees, and that is, you know, Trump says he can act presidential whenever he wants to, and sometimes he does. And then you have weeks like the past week where he gets in and he raves and rants and so on, attacking Republicans whose support he actually needs in the campaign, and yet I think he sort of loses his grip and says things, goes on. He went on for 15 minutes attacking the governor of New Mexico where he was speaking. She's a Republican. She's Hispanic. She's disagreed with him, as far as I know, only over his immigration policy, and yet he spent all this time attacking her. I think that's counterproductive.
I mean, America is a very divided, very unhappy electorate at the moment. And I worry a lot, and maybe this is because I'm, you know, a hand-wringing bourgeois liberal or something. But
I think that's the reason, yes.
That's almost always the reason for everything. But so he goes to Albuquerque, which is a very Hispanic town, which has had trouble with police relations over the last couple of years. He goes to Albuquerque. He does a big rally. There are then protests. You have hotheads on the protesters' side who do politically incredibly stupid things like take Mexican flags down to the protest, jumping on police cars, and you see cable news TV nonstop coverage of people with Mexican flags smashing up police cars in the streets of Albuquerque. Same thing happened when Donald Trump went to give us a rally at the University of Chicago, again, a very left-wing town full of African Americans. I think that Trump is doing this deliberately. I think Trump knows that it suits him to have cable TV full of left-wing young anarchists or, you know, militants smashing stuff up. And when they have Mexican flags, it suits Trump down to the ground. Because if he has that atmosphere of chaos and lawlessness and foreigners attacking America, it suits him absolutely down to the ground. Well, and we're going to see more of this.
You may be right, particularly the Mexican flags, which can always
disastrously
be
stupid. Yep, but
it is. Anyway, we have one more subject we're going to try and discuss that doesn't involve Donald Trump, actually, or at least directly, and that is this question, Abdi, of transgender Americans, of which there are really not that many. The numbers, I think, are something between, the estimates I've seen are something between 20,000 and 70,000. It's a pretty small number. And yet, whether depriving them of a man who decides that that he is a woman may want to go to the women's bathroom, and this is what it's come down to. It seems like a very odd debate. And anyway, that's what it's about. Should that transgender person be able to go to the bathroom of his or her choice? Public bathrooms.
I think on a higher level, it indicates something much more fundamental. David mentioned earlier when he was talking about Donald Trump, he mentioned how divided America is. And I think when you know the background of where this legislation is coming from, originally coming from guidelines issued by the Obama administration, who is pursued to be either an atheist or to be a left-wing zany, wanting to take America, particularly in states where religion or religious beliefs are said to be espoused fundamentally and staunchly, wanting to basically disrupt those beliefs. And these are obviously very explosive issues. They are very important issues, no matter how mundane the basic thing, which is basically allowing people to choose the bathroom that they want to choose in schools.
Well, it's an issue that's not going to go away, and one that I never would have thought would become a national issue, the issue of particularly, as some of the opponents say, men in the women's room. But that's all the time we have today. Joining us today were David Rennie, the Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV,
This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Thanks for listening.